Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we're talking social movements.
We're a social movement, Tony, and we'll be a bigger social movement when we get more patrons. What we need is more patrons. So please, patrons, come on to the website. The website is, Tony?
Patreon.com/tortoiseshack. This is the first time he's actually... I had this joke ready to say about his lack of movement, but anyway, he's ruined it now. I let you away with it this time. Much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined in the Tortoise Shack by writer, activist, teacher, editor, and working with social movements in Ireland and globally. Lawrence Cox. Lawrence, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It would be unfair to say that we've been talking about this for a while, Lawrence.
We've been swapping texts.
We've been bouncing backwards and forwards and you've been like you've written some of the most interesting stuff on social movements that I've seen on Irish Twitter, as we like to say. Do you want to just give us a bit of an idea about your background before we tell listeners why? Interest in social movements, for starters.
I suppose I grew up in them. Yeah. I've been in movements now for me since the 80s. Different kinds of things. I spend a lot of my time these days trying to help people who are in movements think about what they're up to, what could work, how it could work better, how we can win, because like the scale of what we're up against, just going, sure, let's just do something, anything. And, you know, if enough people hear that things are bad, it'll change. And, you know, sometimes that works and a lot of times it doesn't.
Rarely that works, tell the truth.
Yeah, if there's not much opposition.
Yeah.
If you're pushing, and it sounds nice.
If you're pushing against an open door.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think things can work once. I think they rarely work twice the same way.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say that in the last, I suppose, we talk about Ireland now as how it's worked in terms of, say, marriage equality, the repeal movement, water charges. Is it fair to say that we have shown that people now are actually more engaged in social movements than they were previously? Or am I just seeing things with recency bias?
Well, it feels pretty good, doesn't it? It feels good if you've been around, you know, as long as the three of us have, without wanted to put numbers on it. Things have definitely got better. And if you spend time in like Southern England or white America, you go, my God, these places are feckin' movement deserts. You know, people in Southern England think Extinction Rebellion is like this mass movement that's about to overthrow the state. And you go, hang on a sec. We've seen what that looks like. It's nowhere near it. But, you know, in fairness, if you go back as well, we're one of the few countries in the world where the peasants actually got the land. You know, we're one of the first places, to break free from the big empires in the 20th century. One of the only places to reject nuclear power outright. So we kind of got some form on this.
Okay.
Yeah. You know,
I hadn't thought of it in that context.
Yeah. Well, we had some big movements in the past. We had the PAYE strikes, which were for their time, were unprecedented. Yeah. It was an unprecedented movement. Yeah. And it worked. It was really effective for a while.
Yeah. Pushers out.
Yeah.
Huge community activism on all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Shell to Sea.
So Shell to Sea is one. And then we have the makings of another one with the fracked gas coming offshore. If we can get some cohesion on it.
Depend on what happens there.
So these movements have been in Ireland for a very long time. We've had some quite successful. I mean, the water protest in recent memory is one of the most
amazing.
Successful.
Yeah, absolutely amazing.
What do you put the success down to?
Jesus. I think two things. One is that community activists got free from the community organizations because the organizations had all got into partnership, so they weren't going to do anything. But when people started getting letters in the door, they had to go, well, what are we going to do? Who do I know who's going to do something? Who's going to come out and stand outside when they come to put in these meters? So they reinvented it. That's one thing. The absolute stroke of genius, and I really want to find out who came up with it, was not the first big march in Dublin, but the second one where they said, let's do stuff in local communities.
Yes.
And suddenly people could see, well, if I'm standing outside in a month or 2 months, I'm not going to be the only idiot, and people won't be given out to me. They'll be out there with me.
And it lashed rain that day. It lashed out of the heavens.
And people went out in insane numbers. Yeah. And they also saw, if I don't register, or later if I don't pay, there's no way they could take us all to court. Absolutely. And then the cops saw that later on, because, you know, it's the same government that had, you know, pulled all kinds of stuff in Rossport. Absolutely no objections there to battering the hell out of people. And there will have been people at the cabinet table saying, why don't we just send in the feckin' riot squad? Probably several times. And other people going, I don't think that's a good idea.
I do remember the riot squad at the side of Dáil Éireann, to be honest with you.
In the city centre, yeah.
Yeah, I do.
Absolutely, I've seen them. But what I would say on that, in terms of...
But you compare it to Rossport.
Yes.
You know, the level of violence that they're willing to... Very happy with.
And what happened in Rossport was, and still to this day, is something that most people haven't forgiven. A lot of...
Funnily enough, it never got the huge traction that water protests got.
Sure. Yeah.
And that was whatever was missing in the communications. It didn't spark the same way.
I'll tell you why, because, and Lawrence pointed it out there, because you were able to, even if it was just yourself, you were able to realize, if I don't send back this direct debit, what are they going to do? And people then realized, they kept saying the majority of households have paid something, and going, well, that's not true, because if you're only brought in 12 million and you're supposed to be bringing in 60 million, no one's paying, you know. And there was a silent majority that were saying, I'm just going to wait it out and see what happens. And that brought it down as well. So it was a buzz flush, and they kept saying, you know, oh, the next month it went up to, say, 24 million. Oh, there's more people paying. No, it's the same person has paid another
quarterly installment. Yeah.
And when you factored it down, it was around, whatever, 16% of people were paying. I remember Paul Murphy did the numbers on it quite well.
You did, yeah?
And I was going to say, because you could see when he got four or five different numbers the same month, they were pulling them out of their arse.
Yeah.
So they had no clue, really, who was supposed to pay, who had paid, who was registered or whatever.
So all you had to do was sit there and say, like, first of all, there was a data breach because you hadn't registered and things were coming out with your name on them. It shouldn't have happened. So, you know, there was collective action. If it was possible, or that could have happened. But to go, like, so bring it forward, as Martin was talking about. You mentioned Extinction Rebellion. In terms of the climate action, the climate movement, it failed as a, and failed is a strong word, but it never really materialized at the ballot box in the most recent general election. Do you think that the climate movement, where should they look for hope, and where should they see what policies or what movements there can be?
Oh my God. You're not asking small questions, are you? Well, look, the people who've been most effective at resisting climate change are Indigenous populations who've been directly disrupting extraction and pipelines. Yeah. Particularly like what's going on in Canada is a very typical example. In Canada, a few years ago, I don't know if it's still true, but certainly a few years ago, they were managing to stop one of these projects in two because they're very, very vulnerable. But also the people who are resisting, even though it's small numbers, they're incredibly poor. But their backs are against the wall, they're very cohesive, and they're prepared to go a very long way.
Yeah.
You know. Same with Sarawiwa and people in Ogoni. And, you know, even in Rossport, in a sense we lost, but it took them 15 years to get their project through. You know, their budget went from 800 million to over 3 billion for that. And then, like quite often happens, when the issue of fracking came up a year later, the government basically like surrendered before, almost before a shot was fired. And, you know, people did a lot of work on the ground in Leitrim, Clare, those other West Midlands counties. But by comparison with Rossport, you could see that the state was like, we're just not going to get into this. We cannot win here.
Yeah.
You know, let's not really push it and bring in that legislation like 2 years after Rossport went through.
You've talked about what movements are up against, and you kind of referred to it there against or there again. What is it exactly that they're up against? Is it this big hegemony that is a cohesive wall where everything is controlled. Every message that come across is scripted. And they know what they want. They know how they're going to get it. They know how to defeat the enemy. Some people might think this is off the head, but we had a guest in here and during austerity, the vast majority of media accepted austerity without question. Without question.
Hey, Dr. Aileen Maron, she did PhD on it and showed that the playbook was to frame it in such a way. And you know, that's, she did it and she analyzed it. I suppose, yeah, and referred to it as a playbook. Is there a playbook? Or is it just experience?
I think it's not so helpful to think of the people we're up against as like all powerful, omniscient and so on. You know, for one thing, in this country, we've defeated them on so many fucking things. Yeah. You know, if you think just about church, gender, sexuality, the stuff that seemed absolutely impossible to overcome when we were growing up.
Yes.
It's gone. You know, you walk around Maynooth, you won't see a dog collar from one end of the year to the next.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're either going around in camouflage or they've dug themselves little tunnels so that nobody accosts them. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's like walking around a ruined castle or, you know, the kind of, you know, old secret police headquarters turned into museums in Eastern Europe. It's not that the church has totally gone away, but, you know, that sense, that comes from us, that sense that they're indestructible. With the media stuff, the media are usually on the side of the state and big money, because that's usually who owns them, you know, with a few exceptions. That's no great surprise. It's never stopped, you know, actual revolutions happening. You know, virtually no revolution has happened because with the media clapping it on. It doesn't happen, and yet they happen all the time because it's not all that people listen to, you know. And come back to water charges. We saw this. We saw Lorraine Higgins freaking out. Because ordinary people were talking to each other on social media. What we were saying on social media was not what RT and the Irish Times were putting out there. Yeah. Never mind Dennis O'Brien's media. And, you know, we're capable of doing that. Sometimes, sure, it's possible for them to totally cut off our communications. And I think right now, you know, the work that you're doing is actually really important, because we're seeing the right wing kind of come into Facebook, come into Twitter. It's becoming a very strategic battleground for them.
I'm seeing podcasts being corporatized.
I'm squeezed out.
I genuinely said it yesterday. I don't know of any other independent news and politics podcast left on in Ireland now. And there was other ones when we started, and their independence has been denuded.
Power to the podcast, Tony. Power to the podcast.
Like, what I'm saying to you is, if you're sitting at home and you're listening to this and you think I could do that, there's no barriers to entry. Get in and do it.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Because the simple fact is, when I look around, there's not enough. And that's no knock on some of the ones that, like, I listen to the Irish Times one, but it's still the Irish Times one. Yeah. It's not independent.
What movements are interesting you at the moment, worldwide, not just in Ireland? What movements are interesting you, do you think, besides climate action?
Can I come back to that fantastic question in
one
sec?
Of course you can,
yeah. Because I wanted to come back to this podcast thing and say, I don't know if you remember, but 20-odd years back, you know, we were doing paper, print, lefty things, and we were doing them with, you know, we'd gone from Gestetners to, you know, sliding in and using the Doyle printer, massive great long arm staplers, and get them out in all sorts of ways. And we were, you know, we were roaring that we couldn't get our stuff into Eason's.
Yeah, right.
And that was the problem then, was print and that distribution. And now it's, how do the algorithms work? How do things get flagged as fake news? How do things get corporatized? You know, it's a moving frontier, but the fact that we lose terrain doesn't mean that we should give up. It's more like, how do we own more of our own means of production, means of producing ideas? You know, look, Marx started as a radical journalist, right? It's what got him kicked out of one country after another, as he was a troublemaking journalist.
Yeah.
And he says at one point, look, the first freedom of the press is the freedom not to be a business. And then he goes on, separate bit, It's always, you know, the class that owns most of the means of production that owns most of the means of intellectual production. Mm. That's not going to change, but actually the stuff that we can do matters.
Yes.
Yeah. And sometimes it matters enough to win.
I think it's a really good point, because I'll be honest with listeners. We've been approached by bigger platforms and they've said to me things like, and I'm not speaking out of turn here, they've said to me things like, if you come on with us guys, you'll feature on this iTunes page, you'll feature there. And I'm going, oh, so that's not a meritocracy. It's, you know, that's what you're telling me. Mm-hmm. And I'm listening to this.
That's how it works.
And yeah. And when people go mad at me, say, Tony, you go on too much about the Patreon stuff. I go, yeah, because we want to stay independent. Yeah. I don't want to go with that crowd that are saying to me, come on board and we'll do the deal that way. So you're right. Yeah. We need to make sure that we maintain a ferocious independence. That's why, again, the call is other people who think, yeah, you know, the barriers to this are very low. Get out there and do it. Back to Martin's question.
Yes. Movements worldwide that you are interested in or you think are interesting.
What is going on that's worth looking at? I think there's two separate sets of things. So there's a very difficult, very bitter battle at the moment in country after country where the far right's come to power. Quite a surprise for a lot of people, quite fast for a lot of people, and it's shaped very differently if you're in Hungary, let's say, or India, or the US, and you see the whole kind of battlefield, playing board, landscape, whatever you want to call it, changing very, very quickly. And we've got to pay attention to that stuff because, you know, so many of these are places that you would have said 10 years ago, this is grand.
The largest democracy in the world was what we call India for the last number of decades.
Yeah.
And Arundhati Roy was writing about the current president of India about what was, let's face it, on the equivalent of a genocide in, it was a Gujarat province.
In Gujarat, in 84.
I mean, these things happened in my lifetime.
Yeah.
And this man is now in power and oversaw these things. And we're supposed to, and they still refer to it as the largest democracy in the world. And you're going, how can you do that when this guy has so much blood on his hands?
So we got to pay attention to what people are doing in those different places and see what works. Mm. Because a lot of what people do is just panic and they just carry on acting out. Mm. You can see a lot of the American center, in inverted commas, just acting out. This is who we like to be, this kind of sort of centrist dad persona that actually I'm more invested in being a certain way and kind of having my way of talking about the world be heard than whether it's true or not.
The cult of civility, maybe?
I'm going to carry on talking this way as we sink, as, you know, as they come for me. It's like, you know, it's one kind of privilege, you know. But on the upside, things to really look at, there are Chappas and Rojava, really. And look at these places where there are people who are so poor, have experienced so much oppression for so long, and the scale of what they've managed to achieve with, you know, under extreme intense pressure, you know, even now in the middle of the Syrian civil war, you know, it's, there's something really important to be learned there. And I'm not going to pretend that I know what it is, except to say they're onto something there. Yeah, and a lot of the stuff that seemed nice here, Venezuela, for example, because that was familiar. Mm. Yeah, big, strong man in a Latin American nation state. We like that stuff with a party behind him. Mm. And then you look at these things and they're either one's an indigenous population, one's a stateless people. Neither of them are trying to have their own revolution in one country and the big leader leading the state. And they're mostly led by women.
Yes.
And that's really significant because, you know, they've got their version of what I don't know if you've followed this stuff. Gwen Snyder's been talking about the dirtbag left.
Yes.
Really interesting stuff. Where you get just these kind of white dude bros who sort of swan in and do their I'm a white celebrity guy thing and just put themselves at the front of stuff. But of course you get that in indigenous politics as well. And actually that's very much what Kurdish politics in Iraq is like. Mm. But when you say, okay, it's actually the women in these communities who are really important, then you're breaking up those kind of local big man relationships that lead people to actually change nothing at all at the grassroots, but make it look a little bit different at the top for international consumption or whatever. And you see the power that comes from that when people mobilize on that basis because they're actually revolutionizing their everyday life.
I think it's a really good example because we've seen and spoken to people who have stood alongside those women who fought alongside those women, and we've been, you know, and they've spoken about the democratization of the movement and how it is local democracy, not you know, it's village by village, community by community. It's not as you said an overarching strongman.
It's model. Probably good that he's in jail. From that one point of view, and I don't know any Kurd who would like to hear that, but from the point of view of the movement's health, it's actually better to have the figurehead out of sight.
Well, there's a touch of sort of Nelson Mandela to that the best work was done in the movement whilst he was incarcerated. I mean, the great leaps forward happened in the movement and backwards too. I'm not saying it was all one way street, but it's good to have a figurehead like that.
That's an actually
they play different roles, don't they?
Yeah. They're different roles.
And of course, he should be liberated. Just absolutely, to be very, very clear about that.
Just to say a point that Martin made there, unbeknownst maybe, that not all movements are progressive,
and
you've the rise of the right. And the actual unapologetic right now, you know, because we've had a ruling class who have been of the right for decades, but we now have unapologetically of the right. Is there, you know, should we be more concerned about this, or are we creating boogeymen, do you think?
Well, not everything that looks like a movement is a movement. Yeah. There's a lot of astroturfing because movement is a valuable thing to be. Yeah. It's a valuable thing to look like. And look where we are. This is a very ambiguous place in that respect, right?
Mm.
Because there is this, there is the land war, there is this big national struggle, but it also goes through a process where, not just a certain class gets the land and the landless labourers get squeezed out, but also where, you know, the first son gets the land at the expense of the relatives. And, you know, the church is then kind of like the icing on the cake of that. And it is, you know, there is class progress there. There's political progress not to be part of the empire, but then it comes with this huge cost. And we have taken so long to get out from under that. Mm-hmm. You know, this thing that a lot of us have been counting for some time, like what proportion of the population is voting for, you know, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, is pretty much that. Mm-hmm. It's counting how effective, and you can see it's very, very age related.
Yes.
People's loyalty, understandably. You know, if you come from that generation, you know, my father-in-law who remembers hiding his shoes going to school because he was the school teacher's son and nobody else had shoes.
Mm.
Yeah. And spending a year in hospital with TB, you're going to be very, very loyal to that national development that's seen things get better.
Yes.
And South Africa's got the same problem, right? Oh, you know, this is the trouble of getting out from under the ANC.
Yeah.
Is, you know, the shack dwellers have been doing it, the miners have been doing it, but that huge embedded loyalty to the party of the revolution, it's a problem in so much of the world. So That's not a simple answer about the right, but often those are the right wing movements that are hardest to shift because they have done something.
Yeah, I agree. I hadn't, again, I'm glad you broadened it to that because I think of, you know, I think of when Nelson Mandela became president and how quickly he was captured, his government was captured by the right wing neoliberal model. Yeah. And, you know, and inequality actually accelerated.
Yeah.
Rather, because, you know, it didn't, the revolution, if you want to use that term, didn't end the day he got out of prison or the day he became president. But unfortunately, a lot of the revolutionary mindset then did. And what happens then is people consolidate and you end up with this idea of, well, we have, as you said, they owe a loyalty. And there is that in Ireland as well. Absolutely.
Gotcha.
But we have seen in the last election where the vote is now diminished to below even putting together a joint government. They can't even get together and put together a government. So that's never happened.
A lot of us never thought we'd see it.
No, yeah. And
it looked impossible like, just a few years back.
When we started this podcast, it was Lorcan Sir came in and told us that it was inevitable. And he didn't tell it. He didn't tell us on air. So I'm giving away secrets here. Mm-hmm. But he said he put his hand up and he kind of did this graph in the air with us, and he said, "This is where it is, and this is where it's going, and this is the inevitable decline." And you know what that and nerds are like. But he wasn't wrong. Do you think that because Ireland has seen itself now, say, if you put it together, the argument now is that Sinn Féin now are a populist movement and not a left-wing movement. I'm not going to, you know, I don't want to really go into the weeds on that other than to say, are we actually looking at a people who are have just rejected that hegemony, for want of a better word, and now do you think they can articulate what change actually means?
God.
Giving you all the mean questions.
Oh, aren't you just? Look, when Republicans said movement in the past, they meant something very different, you know.
Yeah.
They meant the party and the paramilitaries. That was the movement. Mm. So when we're talking about movement today, we're meaning something else. And we're meaning partly this difference between the party that might be in power and people actually self-organizing on the ground. Mm. And it's pretty damn ambiguous, isn't it? Yeah, because I hate to keep coming back to the water charges, but in Dublin, it is the central thing. The Shinners were not great in the water charges. They weren't awful, but they weren't great.
Yeah.
They were not comfortable with the breaking the law end of things.
Yes.
You know, despite all the Fine Gael scaremongery. But at the same time, for the first time in my memory, we actually saw left parties, include the Shinners in that, and unions and community activists working together on a broad basis, not just, you know, to do one little platform. Mm. And with all the problems and so on, that got somewhere. We're not at that anymore. That's not what we're looking at. And it's ambiguous because I was certainly taken by surprise. I think a lot of people were by how effective vote left, transfer left was. Yeah. Not expected because we haven't seen that before. It's not how left politics has worked. And that's fantastic. It's a real sea change. And it says we've got a very politicized electorate now, but there's also a problem. I hesitate to argue with Rory while he's not here, but let me do it because he's got the platform to do it.
I'm glad you are.
Rory and other people who I've got a huge amount of time for have been going around for the last 13 years since 2007 saying housing will be the next big movement. Yeah. And it never actually has been. You know, not on the scale of the water charges, not on the scale of repeal. Mm. There's a good reason for that, which is that people are in such different situations. Yeah. Homeless people, people getting repossessed, people in the PPP situation, renters getting squeezed out. They're not all the same situation. And it's very hard to get a big housing movement together, except defensively, if there are hundreds of thousands of people in one situation getting squeezed. So there's a logic to that being represented more by political parties than by grassroots movements. And there's a logic to what I understand, but Rory can speak for himself in his own time, has been the strategy of, well, let's try and get the unions involved. Let's not even piss on the Labour Party, despite everything they've done to our communities. Mm. But there's a problem there, which is the same problem that arises if you treat the Green Party as representatives of ecology, which is that these are the people who stood by while the military were used against protesters in Rossport. And if there's that gulf between self-organisation on the ground and a party, it's a problem. The Shinners are clearly, as a party, they're very determined. They're capable of acting with a great deal of discipline. They're also capable of switching with a great deal of discipline. And their politics in the North has not been this radical anti-austerity politics at all. They're capably being pushed. So the Drám Dearg, the Irish language activists and others pushed them. They've had to be pushed rather more on abortion, particularly in the North. They're not naturally a movement party in this sense. It would be fantastic to see a left government. Like a lot of us, I'd even hold me nose and go, all right, Labour in there, if they were, or, maybe supported from the sidelines.
One last chance, just for old time's sake.
Even Eamon Wright, Jesus Christ, Eamon Wright, but it wouldn't mean very much without a big movement outside it.
Yes.
And what we might get would be they'd burst the housing bubble and that would be it. And they'd spend the rest of the, they expend all their political capital on that and spend the rest of their time just trying to stay afloat. Unless there's much bigger push behind them. And that's the risk at the moment, is elections are like when you hear that your neighbour's just won the lotto and you go, right, let's run out,
That's great analogy.
You can see what's happened to the English and the Welsh. With Corbyn, there was this thought, oh God, we might just win it. Lads, let's get together a syndicate. Let's put all our eggs in. Oh shit.
Yeah.
And we don't know what the Americans are going to do. But certainly what happened with the Yanks after Sanders in 2016 was there was actually nothing. That energy did not go anywhere else because it was all the eggs into the political party basket.
Well, it did actually. It went into trying to ruin Sanders 4 years later.
No, but the Sanders people.
Absolutely. But it never coalesced. They never found a common ground. And they still now, there's still resentment. They're still boiling up. And there's now what you've seen is the moderate, and there's no more dangerous phrase in politics than a moderate Democrat. The moderate Democrats are now stepping out of the race. So to give Biden to clear the path for Biden. Mm. And this is strategic. And, hearing people refer to Joe Biden as a center left candidate, and I'm just shocked. I do think this year in the US is crucial. I think we're looking at potentially 4 more years of Donald Trump. And when he knows he's only got 4 more years, imagine what he'll go around when he has no consequences. He doesn't have to get reelected again.
Yeah.
Just back to the Irish scene.
Yeah.
We have a union movement within Ireland. Mm. Now, it has lost purchase and it has lost strength basically due to partnership. It lost its strength due to partnership. It is a viable movement for many, many issues. And its home is no longer Labour. We can't say that anymore. That doesn't hold anymore. Do you see the Labour movement in Ireland growing stronger and looking for new political allegiances?
I'd like to say I'd prefer to see the Labour movement not looking for political allegiances, looking to be strong enough that parties come to them.
Okay.
Rather than, we're a place that the Labour Party dumps its spare people, or that, we hope that when we float off the top of this or that union, that's where we're going to go. Because that revolving door, it's been fragmenting for some time. It already started to fragment back with the Sticks and then Dem left. And again, when Unite and the others pulled away from Labour in the water charges, it's going to have to, unions, the big unions and the big institutionalized union movements, they're like oil tankers, you know, trying to move them, they're really, really slow.
Yeah.
But that's separate from their members' willingness to fight. And it's separate from the kind of new unionization that's happening around the place. So there's scope for that. But if you look at the rest of the world, because these debates about new unions, radical unionizations, they've been going on for hell of a long time. And they're not wrong at all to say this is the way unions should go. But
it's
in practice,
a huge power base.
It just proves so
slow.
So slow. And the tendency of most union bureaucracies is to stick doing the thing, you know, is to do what the Catholic Church has done, is to kind of go, this is the thing that we know how to do.
And they keep doing it.
We keep doing it, even though there's fewer and fewer members, it's older and older, but we're going to do this thing. Mm. And breaking that, you know, there's no country where you would say that's totally broken. The new unionization waves in the States, you know, the kind of stuff that Jay McAlevey talks about, that's really exciting. And it's exciting because it's happening in places that people would normally say, you cannot unionize.
Yes.
Yeah, these groups, this is just like dead territory. Forget it.
I mean, my logic tells me that the best opposition for want of a better word, the employer power is worker power.
Sure.
It is without doubt worker. Mm. And we so underutilize it in this country. Mm. We're afraid to use it. Mm. That muscle only has to be flexed every couple of years to get a result. It only needs, you don't have to flex it all the time. Yeah. It just has to be cohesive.
And, you know, sometimes it is incredibly effective. But, the trouble with talking about unions is very often, you know, it's a bit like talking about community activism. There are relatively few people who are in a position to do anything about it. Like you can do what you can in your own workplace. Mm. Or you might be operating at that level within a union or trying to organize some new group. But most of the time, it's just giving opinions about what you hear, which is often just fragments. You know, the same with community activism. You know, that you know stuff is happening and you see this and you go, it's really interesting. And this stuff, and you go, oh, Jesus, they're doing this thing again. You know, I think the only opinion that's, yeah, absolutely, we should be fighting and we should be fighting against partnership. Those two things are absolutely true. But it's not so helpful, I think, to be kind of mentally wargaming with it. Yeah. You know, I mean, we do that with parties because it's kind of fun and because we know it's not going to happen. But it's more destructive when we're doing it with movements.
You sit there and you see, and you all sit around, and you've solved all the problems, and none of it's implementable. What the hell was the point?
Yeah.
I'm going to move us on because I think it's important. You have a new book coming out. And it's a fascinating subject. It's a bit out there.
It's a bit. Come on. Everybody knows people like this guy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
No, we don't.
No. All right. Well. You know, we all know people who left school around 12.
Mm.
Yeah, we all know people who maybe went to England and then said, "Fuck this." And this guy's case worked his way across the Atlantic. This is kind of 1870 now, so we don't know that many 1870s people. And then we're migrant workers in the States. That's not so unusual. Becomes a bit more unusual when you go, all right, okay, 5 different aliases, and there's kind of 25 years of his bio that he draws a discreet veil over in the middle of some of the toughest movements in American history, and then washes up in Asia, and suddenly he becomes this big anti-colonial celebrity. And do you know, when I do talks about this guy, you do meet people, and they're very often dubs, who go, actually, do you know, I've done this or I've done that, and this does relate to a lot of my bio. But what this guy does, he becomes a Buddhist monk at a point where the empire is really, really tied to Christianity. So just like here, if you're defending the local religion against the colonial religion, you can get a long, long way.
Yeah.
And he stomps around Asia for about 14 years, saying, basically, look, the empire, it's coming for you with the Bible and the whiskey bottle.
The Gatling gun.
And the Gatling gun, which is quite a powerful message. And, it, you know, it's not wrong either. So he gets put on trial for sedition, faces death, disappears. You know, it's not the... We do know some activists like that, but not too many, typically. You know? But it's an Irish story, isn't it? Not at all. Not a bit of it.
When is it out?
It's out in May. But here's the thing about it. While he's doing this, he is a major celebrity from, like, Japan to Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, whatever. And then he disappears, and the story gets forgotten. But within kind of, within one generation of that, that empire that seems so powerful is gone. It just dissipates in the wind. Yeah. The Japanese roll up the British and French and Dutch empires. And then when they come back after the war, the nationalist movements basically just go, you know, buzz off. And, you know, it's different in Vietnam, for example. But on the whole, the Brits kind of go, we're not going to win this one, are we? All right, we're going. And I think that's really important to us because we're living in the middle of something and it seems so powerful. It seems like you can't take it down.
Yes.
But if you were the right age, you could actually live through the whole of the British Empire in Burma. You know, they only conquer the middle bit around Mandalay in 1885, and then there's this big counterinsurgency for the next 4 or 5 years. And then this guy's around there 1900 to 1914. And then 1948, it's independent. You know, if you were an older Burmese person, you could literally live through the British Empire. So, you know, when you were talking earlier about, you know, is it all gamed out? Is there just this massive hegemony? You know, of course those things are real. But also, none of these power structures last too long. The kind of sort of Fordist welfare state, it's a few decades. Fascism, it's a few decades. State socialism, it's a few decades. High imperialism, it's a few decades. These things do not last forever. Yeah, and we're coming close to the sort of...
Bounce back.
Well, the sell-by date, really, or the, you know, the use-by date of neoliberalism. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's really important to just have that kind of bigger perspective.
Yeah.
And to say to ourselves, look, you know, sometimes like, you know, you're walking through Dublin and, you know, it just kind of bears down on you. But a decade after this guy in the 20s, people are translating into Burmese things like Kevin Barry, Guerrilla Days in Ireland, because they're going, how did the Irish do that? How did the Irish get out from under the empire? And then, of course, they do it as well. And that's the single biggest thing that happens in the history of the 20th century, yeah? Most of the human race is Asian, you know, about 60% then and now. The 20th century starts with Asia and Africa basically painted the colours, you know, in those old globes and maps, painted the colours of 4 or 5 European empires. And by 1960, most of it's gone. And it goes like that. Yeah, and this has happened within living memory.
You mean to tell me history didn't they start with the Greeks and then the Romans and then the Brits? I thought that's all it was.
Yeah. But, you know, we get, you know, we just come, we naturally just come to take it for granted and we come to think the way things are. You know, even when we know, you know, and we can tell our kids or whatever, let me tell you what it was like with the priests when I was growing up. You know, and, you know, I have to tell me students, let me tell you, before there was contraception, what it was like. And they look at me like I have 3 heads. But that's, you know, that seemed like it was here forever and it's gone. So that's really important for us to bear in mind.
I think it's a really good point. I think these things aren't intractable. Nothing lasts forever. Lines on a map, you know, that we we bring countries come and rise and fall. This is the shape of history. We have so many centenaries at the moment. You know, we talk about Sykes-Picot. We talk about all these things that happened 100 years ago and how these places no longer exist. And you even think when you mentioned Rojava, you talk about these things that are happening today. I'm going to go back to where I started with Arundhati Roy, and she talks about the lifestyle wars, and these wars are being fought, whether we are cognizant of them or not, in our name quite frequently. Last thing for me, and it is in terms of a social movement, if it's to be dynamic, what would be some of the things that you would like to see from people?
Oh God.
Just a couple of things that you think work.
You keep on flooring me with these big questions. People have to organize themselves. That's the number one big thing, is not rely on somebody else to do it. You know, however cool you think, you know, it might be Mary Lou or it might be Öcalan or whatever. People have got to organize themselves, because what really makes a difference, you know, this is where I really agree with you, Martin, about trade unions. What makes a difference is people's power on the ground. Yeah. And you know, if you're in a workplace where workers have got power, you feel it. Yeah. If you're in a community where the guards can't force in water beaters, you feel it. And you feel the difference if you go somewhere where that is not the case. So it's that building of power at every little level, not just I'm going to vote and they're going to sort it out for me, or I'm going to pay me money and somebody else is going to do it for me. It's that self-organizing. That's the single biggest thing. Everything else.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. I think it's super important to be self-reliant. The cavalry isn't coming.
There is no cavalry.
You are the cavalry. So, you know, be self-reliant. When you're being an activist, don't expect somebody to back you up. It's not going to happen. It's simply not going to happen.
Yeah.
Just keep on. That's it.
And talk to your friends. Talk to people in your workplace. Talk to your neighbors. People. See who you can get on your side. Because that's the one thing we're very, very good at in this country is... we're very nervous of sticking our neck out individually, but when, you know, like coming back to, you know, Rossport, for example, or the water charges or whatever, when we look left and right to see how other people feel the same as me on this, then you find you can do a lot. It was one of the big things we found, maybe finish on this, in Dunstore's strike. Yeah, because the strikers initially, Mary Manning and the rest of them, they didn't really know anything about South Africa. All they knew was the union, IDATU, which is now Mandate, had this policy against handling South African goods, and they weren't going to do it. That was all they knew, was like they were loyal to their union, they were going to be good union people, and then they came out and strike, and of course, you know, they learned a huge amount. But what you found on the picket line was 95% of Dubs were in support of them, because so many people had worked in Dun Stores, knew somebody who worked in Dun Stores. It didn't matter what you were on strike about. If you were against Dun Stores, they were on your side.
Yeah.
And that obviously, you know, it comes out, it doesn't come out all the time, but you see it in nurses' strikes, for example. You see it in relation to Ryanair. Yeah, there are a lot of things where you even see it in relation to Rossport. You know, there are some goobers who are like, oh, Jesus, the Republicans were infiltrating that. But most times when you talk to people and you go, well, you know, what do you think that was? They're, you know, they give it to you fairly straight, and they're not that, it's not the Irish Times view of the world, let's say, when you talk to those people, actually.
I think that's a great place to leave it, because that's the truth. I think people generally, Martin always says to me, you got to give people more credit. They can see what's really going on the ground, because they live in the communities.
Yeah.
final thing, just thank you for your time. Best of luck with the book. We'll have to have another conversation again. We might even have to get Rory in so you can have a...
We could have that argument. Yeah.
But best of luck with it and thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for coming in and having this chat with us. Thank you.
Thanks a million to you both.
Last thing, guys, I do have to say, we would appreciate if you head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It does help. It keeps us doing these things and helps put out the stuff.
We need this stuff.
And again, and if you have an idea for a podcast or whatever it is, look, slide into my DMs and let me know. We're always welcome to help people because, you know, it's the barriers to entry are so low. Just give me a shout. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Cheers, bye.
Cheers.